You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
We have, we're very, very lucky to have as our guest John Udell, who's technical evangelist at Microsoft, somebody who has a long background in the public, thinking in public about technology. John and I first met, had to be around 1990. We're not going to tell that story, but I was working for a software company, and I went up to Byte Magazine, absolute fear and trembling, to talk with an editor there as a PR person trying to push my company's product, and it was John, whose stuff I had been reading for a long time. It's been just a pleasure knowing John intermittently over the years. So, he's done many, many things. I'm not going to recount them. He's been a very strong voice in the community for goodness, basically.
So, I want to start with the web page for this very event at the Berkman site. Observe that it's doing one of two things that it should be doing. So the thing that it is doing is it's enabling human beings who visit the web page to find out about events. And the thing that it's not doing is this, right? So where is the data that would enable this event, for example, to reliably syndicate to other calendars? So we can go looking for the data, and we'll notice, okay, this is good. There's a feed. Feed, that sounds like a source of data. It's an RSS feed. I think that must be the way to go. So we'll take a look at the feed. And this is the browser's view of the RSS feed, so it makes it look like a web page. And you know, so I'm hopeful, right? There's some data there. I mean, I need to know when it is, where it is, and that looks promising. So let's actually look at the RSS feed behind the scenes. Avert your eyes, right? So this is kind of what it looks like if you open it up in a text editor, right? It's an RSS feed, and there is actually some machine-readable data here. And so let's highlight the machine-readable data, right? So it is an XML file because it's an RSS feed. So it has tags in it, and so we can identify that there's a channel which has a title, there's an item which has a title and a link, and that's all good. You know, but where is this data of which I speak, right? This is the data right here, okay? We won't go into the details of why the description looks kind of odd. It's because it's HTML, which has been encoded for transmission through RSS, blah, blah, blah. But the point is if I am a machine, if I'm a web service, and I want to make sense of this data, I can't, right? I can't do it. And this is completely typical. Right, so there's kind of this technological tyranny that's going on here for a long time now, because I'll be guilty myself. We technologists told everyone who was publishing to the web, oh, and you will have an RSS feed, right? Or you are just not cool. So everybody made RSS feeds, including RSS feeds that are inappropriate or ill-suited to the task. Right, so an RSS feed, by and large, is a way of pushing headlines and blurbs and links to people, right? It's a news reader. It's mostly operating in the human domain. That's not entirely true. It's possible to embed and encode data inside of RSS feeds. But that's mostly not happening. If you go to 100 events web pages randomly around the web, and say 90 of them have RSS feeds, maybe two of them will have what I'm calling the data, which is what's the date and time of the thing, in some unambiguous way, right? It's just not happening. There's who originally used to talk about this? I got it from Guy Kawasaki, right? This notion of, you know, there's four ways that things can happen, right? You know, and of course, right? If it was the Gartner quadrant, it would be the, but anyway, we're in the top left quadrant here. We want to do the right thing. We want to do it the right way. And a lot of what happens is the right thing, a data feed, but the wrong way, right? An RSS feed is kind of the wrong thing. So let's start with an example that we can all probably relate to. So I got really excited about 10 years ago when this thing called Radio User Land came out because of all the things that it opened up. And in particular, it opened up for me this notion of being a participant in a syndicated network of data feeds. So, you know, we have kind of three functions here, right? We have things that publish RSS feeds. We have things that you know, services that aggregate them. And we have things that subscribe or read them. You know, Userland was kind of interesting because it fit into all three categories, right? So you could use your Radio Userland application to publish a feed, but it also contained within it a service that would aggregate a bunch of other feeds and was also the thing that you could use to read. So it was your feed reader, it was your feed publisher, and it was your feed service. But the ecosystem, you know, evolved other ways of doing these things, right? So we had, you know, over time, many other forms of publishing blog feeds, services that would be registries that would enumerate what these feeds were and draw the data from them together. And then on the other hand, things that could read and subscribe to those things. And this is actually a bidirectional thing, right? I mean, you could use blog lines as a reader, but you could also use it as a publisher, right? So a completely decentralized network of feeds, which could be arranged, you know, in arbitrary topologies, and this is another, I think, great contribution from, you know, from Dave Weiner and from Radio Userland in general, was this notion of the feed that I publish is that's me as I authoritatively represent myself to the web, to the network, right? I am the source of this thing. It's bound to my identity in some sense, right? So let's try to make an analogy to the calendar space, right? So just kind of park that up there as a reference. And so when it comes to analogies, my favorite book is Douglas Hofstadter's Fluid Concepts and Creative Analogies, right? And it's all about little games, little analogy puzzles like this one, right? So what is the ob of Nebraska? Right? So the ob is the mighty river in Siberia. What's the ob of Nebraska? Right. Right? It's a fun game, right? So, you know, what's the Ann Arbor of Texas? Right, right. So, what's the RSS of calendars? Right? Well, we have one. We've had it for 10 years. It's called iCalendar. RFC, I forget exactly, it just changed. It's a 11-year-old standard now. It's wired into all of the calendar programs that we use. You know, Google Calendar, Outlook, Apple iCal, Lotus Notes, right? They all both publish and subscribe to iCalendar or ICS files. Also, and I think this is part of why this isn't really very widely appreciated, it fairly recently became possible to publish right out of your calendar to an internet endpoint, one of these iCalendar or ICS, what I am calling feeds, right? So that being the case, you know, I envision this analog to the RSS and Atom ecosystem in the domain of calendars, right? And the piece that, and so the advantage that I have looking at this, right, is that up here, none of this stuff existed, right? I mean, there weren't publishers and there weren't readers and there weren't aggregators, right? So all that stuff had to be invented. In this case, we already have the publishers and the readers. In fact, we use them every day, right? They're so common and familiar that we don't actually see what they're capable of. So the only thing that we didn't have was this piece in the middle, this aggregation or syndication hub piece. So that's the service that I've built as a kind of a prototype for this idea. So, you know, what would it mean for Amar, right, who I assume is the guy that posts events for the Berkman Center, what would it mean for him to participate in this kind of an ecosystem, right? Well, lots of things flow into the hub, right? So he could be running an Apple computer. He could have his personal iCal program, and he could spin up an instance of a calendar, which was for Berkman events or just Tuesday lunch events. And he could push that out at some endpoint, some URL, which would identify that calendar feed. And he could register the address of the feed with the hub. Right? But other ways it could happen are he could use one of these public services. Right? You could actually put it up on Eventful or Upcoming, Eventbrite, which is sort of for conference type things. But you know, so all of these things are ways of pulling machine-readable calendar information. But I'm actually much more interested in this, right? Because this is the long tail, right? This is what, you know, what all of us ultimately can contribute to this ecosystem, you know, just on a personal level. We all have stuff that we care about and we're promoting. So say Amar put his event here, and it went here, right? Where else could it go? Well, I went and looked around on the web, and it's not hard to find a bunch of different online calendars in Cambridge and around Cambridge that don't mention this event, but could, right? You know, I found a couple different ones at Harvard, incompatible, of course, and you know, there's I guess that's the Cambridge kind of hyper local. I'm not sure even what, you know, I don't live here, so I don't know what all these are, but these are, you know, these are clearly places that could be syndicating from the hub, you know, such that, right? And so, you know, what would that mean, right? It would mean that right now, if Amar wants to populate all these destinations, he has to visit them all, right? Duplicate his data, copy his data into those other places. If it changes, revisit them all again, and so on, right? So, you know, the notion is that this is the right architecture for this kind of thing, a pub-sub syndication network. But it's also, but the hubs don't need to be involved either, right? So that, you know, how did I get this event onto my personal calendar so that it would be overlaid with the other stuff? I had to type it in, right? But if the Berkman Center were publishing a feed, you know, then and if I cared about the stuff at the Berkman Center, I could overlay that, right? So in fact, there's a sort of a peer-to-peer capability here as well, right? So it's completely general in terms of topology, just like the original RSS ecosystem. Right? So these are some places where the hubs exist now on top of the service that I've built. And so what are they not, right? They're not centrally managed databases of events. They're actually not databases at all. They actually don't contain data, really. They're more like routers, right? They're more like ways of orchestrating flows of data. You know, they're not destination sites, right? You know, I hope that what will start to happen is that the legitimate attention hubs in communities will align themselves with this infrastructure, which is all this is, so that if you are, you know, the Harvard Gazette, or you are, you know, Wicked Local News for Cambridge, or whoever you are, right, you know, then you can you know, reflect back to your constituency the aggregated feed or whatever slices of the aggregated feed that you want to present. You know, so what they are, syndicated event networks. It's a free service running in the Azure cloud. That's the Azure cloud platform that's been around for about a year now. I work for Microsoft. I'm building on Azure. If this thing were to scale out and get really big, that would be a nice demonstration of the platform. That's, you know, largely how it is that I get to do this. So that's interesting. But it's an open source thing, right? So the code is open source, the data is open, you know, and what it really is, in my mind, is a way of inviting people to think about what it will mean for us to collectively build the data web, right? we, in one way or another, are all authoritative sources for some or another kind of data. And I want to establish in people's minds the idea that when we are the authoritative sources for data, that we ought to be able to figure out what we're authoritative for and put it up on the net in a way that's appropriate to the kind of data that we are. So this is just an example of kind of the default HTML view of one of these hubs for today in Menlo Park. And you know, this is kind of the dashboard, right? So this thing got this many events from Eventful and Upcoming and Eventbrite, but you know, it's also got some different iCalendar feeds from Stanford that it's merging in. And you can see that, you know, some of those are coming from Google Calendar, but you know, iCalendar is an open standard. There are many implementations of it, and so one of these feeds is coming from you know, something that's built on a Java implementation of iCalendar, for example, right? So lots of different ways to skin this cat. There's no sort of lock in here. So not to sort of you know, create any competition here, because you know, you shouldn't feel bad that the Berkman Center page is the way that it is. Almost every events page on the web is like that, right? This is the rare exception, but it is the case that at Stanford, they've recognized that RSS is a way to push news to people, and iCalendar is a way to push data to applications and services. And so they make an iCal feed available, and so the curator, as I call it, for the Menlo Park Hub, has subscribed to. So this is that view of the Menlo Park Hub, right? And you see there's events coming from Eventful and from Upcoming, but also from the iCalendar feed at Stanford, right? And this is not actually. So I'm not trying to be with my service. I'm not trying to be a destination site or prescribe how this stuff looks. And so actually, the real hyperlocal site where this calendar is being used is using Google Calendar, right? Because Google Calendar actually is a way of aggregating. So one of the outputs that you get from my hub is a combined iCalendar feed, right? So take in stuff from Eventful, Upcoming, et cetera, right, and a bunch of other iCalendar feeds, and produce a single iCalendar feed. It turns out that you can reflect that back out through Google Calendar. So this site has chosen to use Google Calendar as the display widget for this aggregation of calendar events, right? But you see the same stuff, right? So you know, this thing came from Eventful, this is from Stanford's iCalendar feed, and so on and so on. So behind all of this are a set of principles that I'm working on articulating. And so here's one of them. Data has structure, right? This is remarkably unappreciated in the world today, but it is a fact. And so this is, you know, if you open up an iCalendar feed or file, ICS file, and look at it, if you never have, it's a, you know, it's like an old style, Unix text file with values, names and values separated by colons, right? It's pre-XML, even, you know. But it's a way of representing data. So that's a principle here. And then there's this notion of transformation, right? So if I have data, I can transform it into a variety of things, right? So the first thing there is a representation of this event as it appears in the Google Calendar web widget, right? Which is a representation for people to use, to look at the information, to print it out, stick it up on their refrigerators, and so on, right? This is another human-readable representation, right? So that's like a PDF version of it, right? So if you got the data, you can project it out in lots of ways. And then this notion of syndication as a kind of a core principle, right? The notion that I'm authoritative for data, I publish it at an address. The address gets registered, with others. Services can aggregate those things. Other people can consume directly from the origins or through the hubs, right? Another way to look at this. This is a real calendar from my high school. My high school continues to publish a thing called weekly.pdf, which is completely typical, right? I mean, you will see this everywhere. So, if you want to find out whether the soccer game at 2 o'clock at the high school conflicts with your dentist appointment and or you know, a business appointment, right? You know, the notion is you will visit the high school's site, download weekly.pdf, absorb all the information into your brain, absorb other calendars into your brain, and mentally collate, right? Run the computation and match them up, and then you'll know, right? So you know, we have these kind of human readable representations, which are really for people to interact with, and then we have the stuff that computers see, right? So this is what a computer sees when it looks at this PDF file, right? It just sees text. And this is what the computer sees if it looks at this thing here. It sees HTML tags, right? What, if you want to have this data able to be flowed and recombined, though, is you need to show the computer something different, right? You need to show it some structure one way or another, right? The top picture there is an iCalendar representation. The bottom one is an XML version of the same thing. Those are equivalent, but, you know, but fundamentally different from these things in ways that that I have found in going around and talking to lots of people in my community that effectively no one realizes, you know, that you know, educated, intelligent people of whatever age, right? I don't think this is actually generational. Very frequently, maybe almost always, don't appreciate any significant distinction between a .pdf and a .xml, right? They're computer files, right? They're computer files. So, right, you know, the principle of data structure, you know, this is how we talk about events as human beings. This is how computers, one way computers understand them. This is a piece of an iCalendar file. We can go through and we can look at, you know, how is this communicating data? So first of all, right, we have indications of, you know, that this is the start and the location. And then within that, we have, okay, let's see, that date format there has actually got some structure within it, right? It's, you know, there's a convention about year, month, day, hour, minute, and so on. You know, then there's this piece right here, right, which is also kind of critical and is one of the reasons why we have a special format for time-related things. So, you know, an RSS feed is not going to easily be able to communicate what time zone this event is in, right? But, you know, events are both local and global. This event is both local and global. So, you know, I want it to show up on my calendar at 12:30, but, you know, someone might actually be watching from California right now. They'd like to see it on their calendar at 9:30, right? So, you know, we have ways of doing this. Data transformation, right? So we recognize this from grade school, right? These things are equivalent. In the realm of data, we have sort of similar stuff going on. So, you know, let's think of this as an abstract representation of a date. This is how it might look in iCalendar. This is how it might look in an XML version of iCalendar, right? And this is how it looks on the web. Right? So in some sense, these things are equal, right? We can transform one into the other. But another extremely non-intuitive thing to people is that that these transformations aren't necessarily reversible, right? So you know, these are two-way transformations right here, right? You can get in both directions, and these are also. But this isn't. This is not, right? You know, the notion that it's hard to go in this direction is unavailable to most people. Otherwise, most people wouldn't publish data in a form that makes the data inaccessible, right? But people don't intuit this, right? It's like, well, why should it be hard? You know, it's like the XML file, you know, and the HTML file, they both have angle brackets, right? I mean, it's not intuitive why this is hard, but it is. Which suggests that there might be something there that people actually need to be taught. You know, this is kind of like there's a thing that happens in cryptography called the one-way hash, right? You have a function that goes in one direction, not the other. This is actually kind of like one of those. So we're talking about a bunch of computer science-y kind of things here, all of a sudden, right? I mean, we're talking about the structure of data, the transformation, pub-sub syndication, one-way hashing, right? And you know, it's like we're in geek territory here, right? Why should people care? Should they even have to know about any of this stuff? So this is Jeanette Wing. She was head of computer science at Carnegie Mellon a few years back. And she started to advance this notion that there is in computer and information sciences a sort of core of intellectual tools and patterns that really are generalizable and should be generalized and broadly taught, in fact, to everyone at some level, right? And she coined this term computational thinking, which I think has marketing challenges, but this is what she says, right? You know, along with reading and writing and arithmetic, we should add what she calls computational thinking to every child's analytical ability. It is a universally applicable attitude and skill, right? Hence my sort of trial balloon here of saying, you know, there's a fourth R that we're trying to talk about here, right? We've got reading, writing, arithmetic. You know, what is this other stuff, right? What are the commutative and associative laws of networked information systems? And to what extent are there aspects of those that are so fundamental that we actually could and should be teaching them in grade school? Is, I think, an important question. I've been to a few education conferences lately. It's clear to me that educators are kind of creeping in around the edges of this. You know, there's a sense at these conferences that there's something there. We know we need to teach it. We don't exactly know what it is or how we would teach it, but you know, there's something there. And I hear, these are just some of the phrases that I hear, right? I still don't know what the tagline is for this, but there's something in that neighborhood is going on. Right. So here are some interviews that I did with Jeanette and also Joan Peckham. Jeanette went to the NSF, and there's some activity there. Some of you may be connected to it or know about it. This is just kind of one of these examples. This is Phil Libin, who at the time that I interviewed him for my podcast was working for an internet identity company. Now he's the CEO of Evernote, if anybody's an Evernote user. So anyway, but we were talking, and Phil made this really interesting statement. You know, the basics of asymmetric cryptography are fundamental concepts that any member of society who wants to understand how the world works or could work needs to understand, right? And when he said that, I just laughed, right? Because I mean, public key cryptography is famously difficult to explain, right? But you wonder, right? I mean, on some level, the notion of a one-way function is fairly fundamental, right? And on some level, maybe it would be good if people could connect that to the fact that Julian Assange can publish these WikiLeaks insurance files out on the net and what that means, right? What does that actually mean, that those things are out there, right? So this is the high school calendar. I actually had a conversation with the high school principal about this, and this is what he said, right? So, my dilemma is, I want this guy to be teaching my kids a set of principles about how the internet works, what the nature of data is, how it flows and combines or doesn't, right? And those concepts don't really even exist, right? They haven't been articulated in any educational curriculum that I've seen. And this is just, I sort of collect these little examples going around in my community trying to explain this stuff to people, right? So we have had at one time, we still have a chess club in Keene, and they meet on Monday nights. And for the longest time, they met at the Best Western Hotel. Then they moved. They moved to another hotel. And as part of my sort of bootstrap for this thing, I went to Eventful and I put up the correct location, same time, new location for this meeting. And I syndicated that through the hub. So now the hub had, had the right answer. And in theory, I mean, I was acting as a proxy for the person who runs the chess club, but obviously you want the person who runs the chess club to themselves be the source, right? So about 6 months later, I p- picked up the newspaper and I looked in the bulletin board, and lo, there was the chess club at the Best Western, right? Because the model is, you know, that if you're the chess club guy and you want to promote your event to the community, you know, there's no notion that I'm the authoritative source for this data, right? That I can assert that I am publishing this data in an appropriate data format at a URL which is bound to my identity as the president of the chess club, right? And that the newspaper could and should syndicate that information from me, right? So when I change it, it's not a question about did I remember to, you know, send the changed copy, and oh, how many people did I communicate the changed copy to, and so on, right? I mean, it's the nature of syndication, right? Right. So we're sort of missing concepts on both sides of the equation here, right? The citizen, in this case, doesn't have a notion that it would be possible or desirable to publish this kind of data feed, right? And the newspaper, the attention hub in the community, doesn't, you know, for its part, understand the converse, right? That it could be subscribing to that, and then it would actually have stuff that was correct and timely, and that they didn't have to pay interns to transcribe, because they're all doing so well these days that they can afford to do that, right? You know, concepts that are missing, lots of ways to represent structured data. Right? Some work out better for people, some work out better for computers. Pick the right one for the right job. Just this notion, right, that when you've accurately represented a fact in an appropriate data format, you know, you have lossless propagation, right? Is you know, not appreciated. This notion that, you know, if I tell you that the URL for the feed of events that I sponsor is at this address, and I associate that with my identity as projected onto the net, right, you know, then I create the possibility for all kinds of things to happen. You know, one of them being this kind of like loosely coupled, small pieces, loosely joined effect, right, where if you think about it, I've put a service out onto the network, right? You know, at this URL, I am delivering the service of a stream of information which is coming from this authoritative source for this purpose, right? Anyone can combine that, can compose other aggregate services using mine and others, right? This notion of, you know, what programmers talk about as passing by reference versus passing by value, right? We only teach this to computer scientists and information scientists, but it's, you know, in the age of the web, it's actually becoming one of those fundamental things, right? So if the newspaper says to its constituency, this is our community bulletin board, send us your events, and the model is, you know, type up another copy of the event that already is sitting in your personal calendar and make, you know, make that copy transit through the internet, where now I have it, right? That's passed by value, right? And fundamentally different is passed by reference, right? Give me the URL. Give me the URL of the service at which I can refresh my understanding of your authoritative stream of events, right? This concept is completely missing. And from most people, and it interests me that the assumption is that this is a generational kind of thing, right? Like, well, you know, anybody under 25, you know, they grew up with this stuff. They're digital natives. They just intuit this. And my observation is, no. You know, I mean, maybe you see different college students than I do and different high school students, but I'm not seeing people intuiting this stuff, right? Because I think it's actually something that is needing to be taught. Right? And then there's this notion of control, right? So, you know, I want to be in control of that for which I am authoritative, right? I should have that expectation, right? I should expect to advertise the addresses at which the world can come to me for the facts that I assert. And, you know, that's not happening. So I find this to be really hard. And I've been asking myself a lot recently, why is this hard? and we could talk about this, I hope we will, but the conclusion I've come to so far is that the stuff that goes on in cyberspace, we haven't really yet evolved any sort of biological intuitions, real-world physical intuitions about, right? So if you could just grow up in the world as a physical human being walking around, you will at a certain point, I don't know what age Piaget says this happens, but at a certain point, right, you'll get that there's constant volume, right? Because you'll have had enough experience with, you know, liquid in containers of different shapes, and, you know, some of them are this big, and you push it and squeeze it, but, like, it's the same water, right? You get that at some point, right? We don't need to be taught these things. But we do need to be taught the associative laws of arithmetic, right? We don't just get that, right, by being under 25 or having iPhones. You know, we actually have to teach people these things because they're more abstract. Right, so we've designated a set of these kind of abstract things as being critical for basic education, and you know what I'm suggesting is that there is this fourth R set of things. I don't exactly know what they are yet, but some set of things that we could probably agree on as being that fundamental, and that and sufficiently non-intuitive that we actually ought to figure out what they are and how to teach them. So, you know, my larger ambition here is this isn't just about calendars, right? For me, this is an attempt to try to prototype this model of getting these ideas into people's heads by bringing them to an experience that embeds them in an active use of these principles so that they could then be extrapolated to other realms, right? So, in the realm of science, just to take an example, I've got a number of friends who fret about the dilemma that scientists have trying to be internet citizens in a world where they can't get rewarded for the work that they do in online spaces, right? Because, you know, you need to be able to account for the influence that you've had and the contributions that you might make by making a thoughtful blog post as a comment on someone else's blog aren't going to register with the tenure committee. Right. So, from that perspective, I think it's interesting to think about, well, you know, as a working scientist, you know, what set of things am I the authoritative source of, right? How can I publish those things in a way that I have control over? And then how can I invite the world to syndicate that stuff from me, right? So, you know, the model might be I put my comment on, you know, my personal LifeBits archive, which is perhaps cryptographically bound to my identity someplace on the net, right? And now it syndicates into the place where I want to converse with people, but I've got control over that data. I've got control actually over the usage data that comes from that, right? So I have a credible case that I can make for, you know, when I participated in this thing over here, I moved the needle in this particular subdiscipline, and I have the evidence to prove it, right? Because I control that data. So, you know, kind of libraries, a similar thing. I was talking with David earlier about, you know, library OPAC systems are now inviting people to review books, patrons to review books, right? Well, why would I review a book for my own local library, take the time to do that, right, invest those keystrokes, package up that data, stick it into their system, right? And then, I might have also wanted to put it on Amazon and a dozen other places, right? Well, where does it really belong? Well, it doesn't really matter where it belongs. What matters, though, is that I get the opportunity to be the authoritative source, right? To be able to assert that this location on the internet, whatever it is the authoritative source for the stuff that's coming from me, right? Gov 2.0, I've been around this discussion for a while now, and I'm fascinated by the rhetoric around public data, which is almost exclusively at this point cast in terms of government holds archives of data. We want that stuff. Break down the walls. Give us the data, right? And then, you know, we will do magical things with it. Not really recognizing that we are collectively the sources of an awful lot of that data, right? So, you know, flip it around, right? Why don't we think in terms of, you know, collectively being the contributors of stuff? Because we are anyway, right? We're just not doing it in an organized way. Education and... generally, I think this goes to the broader themes of identity, right? You know, that we are, as we project ourselves increasingly into the digital world, we are, we're shedding data just as we move around in the world, right? And other people are collecting, owning, controlling, and making use of that data. Can we look for opportunities? It won't always be possible, but can we look for opportunities for ourselves to be the authoritative sources of whatever data we can be authoritative for? So thanks. I'd really like to hear your thoughts on this. And
Could you go back one slide?
Yeah.
Do you see a common pedagogy for approaching all five of those things at the same time? A common approach to government, to science, to education. I want to home in on education in particular, because you mentioned in government that we hold all this data.
Right.
And the government actually is just a repository for the data. Really, for them, is the canonical source that we want to pull it down. Is self-education a part of this? Like, do you need the schools in order to have computational literacy that you're looking for?
So, yeah, I think that we could distill this down to a list of, 7 plus or minus 2 things that are like the laws of arithmetic,
okay,
right? And that we actually would teach people in grade school, right along with that other stuff, right? You know, appreciate the difference between I give you a copy of data and I give you a link to data.
So in the absence of the schools doing it, should we be homeschooling? That's not...
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm struck by the fact that if we go back 100 years, somebody might be standing in front of a room like this talking about the need to have a conversation in the facility with electric motors or the illumination that we experience.
No, I know.
That we're coming on, or how to connect telephones together over a long distance.
Yes. Yes.
That shifted for us all to a small number of people. If you take what you presented here and shift the model to, instead of these being issues with the nodes, they being issues with the network, with the connections. And so all of this stuff about being the authority and the issues of spamming, cleansing, vetting, and everything is a property of the network, the betweens, instead of the ends. Then this all changes dramatically. And you've got the two things all commingled and as it's presented here, and they aren't. Thanks to Amar and the Berkman feed, I was over at IBM yesterday, and the networking conference by, Christakis? Was really interesting and bears somewhat, I think, on this. Anybody else get over there? Well, interesting stuff. But over time, the people out here on the ends, or the users of that electric motor that's taking the stale air out of here, we don't care about it. We don't want to. We want the benefits of it. And there's a few people on the planet that need to design electric motors. There's a few people who need to drill down into this stuff and understand it. They'll be specialists and be paid a lot. But it isn't my granddaughters. It's not my sons. It's some of the people in this room who want to be involved in it. But to a large degree, it's about us doing things so that we do a lot of complexity, so that it's simple out at the next layer.
Us being technologists.
Yeah, probably. Or we care about it in some way. We have this technology conversation.
Right.
I'm in the middle of on LinkedIn right now. There's this massive conversation about what happened to Digital Equipment Corporation. And it's interesting how many engineers are sure it was a technology problem. That's a piece, but that's not what it's about.
Right.
It's about you're doing something useful to people that they get value out of in some way or another. And it's about, at each generation in a way, it being faster, cheaper, easier.
This is a perennial kind of question about, is this asking people to understand the internal combustion engine or not? One example that I've been using recently is, I noted when Twitter got to be a thing that the technologists, made it seem like a new thing, which in some ways it was, right? But in other ways, in important ways, it wasn't. Right. So, I would say that the pub-sub communication pattern is one of those extremely fundamental things which we can and should explain to people, right? And that, and if we did do that, then it might have been the case when Twitter came along that we could have helped people make an analogy, right? Because you know, I mean, the whole thing about those Hofstadter analogy puzzles is things never quite line up, right? You know, you always have to kind of, you know, so it's not a perfect analogy, but the fact of the matter is, you know, Twitter came up with this term asymmetric follow, right? And everybody's like, ooh, that's cool, right? What is asymmetric follow, right? It is the pub-sub communication pattern, right?
And today, pub-sub may be important, but when I walk out of here and I walk down the street, I don't want to have somebody publish, or I don't want to subscribe to the street signs or an understanding of the signs on the store or something. It's going to be there in the environment for me in a way that I can get it without it appearing that I have to do anything. That's where all of this is heading. So I get PubSub today coming out of the paper world and out of a world of constraints and scarcity. But I think it's a trap to stay in that long term. So I don't think it's going to stay there. The what's going to be possible is going to come not just local, but to you as an individual, for you, only you. It will not look like PubSub.
Oh, no. And that's actually the great innovation of Facebook, right? What Facebook does is it puts me into an environment where we're not actually hitting people over the head with, you know, RSS icons and stuff. But it's actually doing this for me, right? So what's happening is, you know, that I learn that my activities in this environment are shedding data, right, in a way that is discoverable by other people and vice versa, right? But right, what we don't get out of that is intentional and creative use of
Facebook's
it.
Facebook's a really great toe in the water, and I think it's going to have a very short 15 minutes of fame.
I hope so.
Go ahead. I have a question. It might be more of a point of clarification. So it seems to me that your talk has sort of two disparate parts. I'm having a hard time connecting them. So the first half is we need better tools for managing online calendars.
No, we have them. We have tools. We need better concepts.
Okay. So then the second part is that there needs to be better education of computational thinking to young people.
Yeah.
So where is, I guess I'm not quite getting what the linkage is between these two things. What are you seeing people's use or not use of online calendars demonstrating about their lack of computational thinking skills?
Okay. So we'll take my newspaper as an example, but
okay.
Every newspaper,
sure,
except for a few that I'm trying to work with, is like this. So the newspaper would love to be able to synthesize on behalf of its community,
mm-hmm,
a comprehensive view of goings-on in the community. Would love to do that. And citizens would love for the newspaper to do that. And newspapers dramatically fail in doing that, right? And they dramatically fail because the architecture of the solution, which is the only solution that anyone can envision, is fundamentally flawed, right? The architecture is there's a central database,
mm-hmm,
there's a single owner and maintainer of the database. Contributors who want to plug facts into the database need to bring their facts to the database, right? So if imagine, you know, if the web worked that way, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you had to go, you know, to one authority to get a web page published, we wouldn't have a web. So in fact, the web itself, you know, is a model that people actually kind of do understand in terms of, you know, it is a decentralized mechanism for collectively visualizing stuff, right? We haven't made the jump to the data web yet, and there's lots of different arguments around that.
Yeah, but I'm not convinced that that's because of a lack of education on the part of individuals in terms of them not having some kind of basic understanding of computational thinking. To me, it seems more that people are using the tools that exist because it's easy, and that's because what their friends use. Like, for example, the example you gave of the school providing a PDF online. That's very useful if I can just print that out and put it on my fridge and highlight the stuff that I'm going to, and my family doesn't use Google Calendar.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a general model that people have used to organize their family events for many years.
Right.
I mean, maybe not printing out the PDF part, but having a refrigerator with some sort of central calendar on it.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me that you're sort of assuming a normative use for calendars and maybe ascribing a level of sort of intellectual misunderstanding where really it's just kind of habit, circumstance, and tool availability to a certain extent.
Well, it's definitely habit and circumstance.
Yes.
It's not tool availability because the tools exist. They're just not understood.
Well, like Facebook events, for example, it's very, very difficult to add a single Facebook event to your Google Calendar. You can export an iCal feed, but then you have to convert it. then you have to import it into Google Calendar, and the way that Google Calendar shows it is really messed up, and I know this from experience, obviously,
yeah.
right? But people use Facebook because that's where their friends are, and it makes it easy for them to invite people to things.
Absolutely.
It's not because of a lack of understanding on their part of how it works.
There's a back channel question, just so when you're,
yeah, yeah.
When you're
okay.
ready. So.
I want to go, yeah, go ahead.
So I want to go to your principal analogy, back to your principal analogy. I would sort of disagree with you. I would say 10 years ago, he would have no clue how to do a PDF, never heard of a PDF maybe. And today, he knows how to use his email, so that's a sort of ontology that he follows, right? He knows how to do a PDF, he knows his users know, so he's communicating that data to his users. So it seems like if you just focus on your calendar question, not sort of the other questions that you have. You know, my question is, what you're trying to do is take data which people deliver up for calendars in all kinds of ways, which I'm very interested in because I don't know what's going around town. I have to go from one place to the other to
right.
the other. It's not all in Google Calendar. And so and get that into a central format.
Yeah.
And so you can say, everybody, you've got to use Google Calendar, or you've got to use this ontology, and you sort of do semantic computing. But my question is, why don't you just take cognitive computing, let it run through all the databases that it wants to here in town for Boston, and then deliver back to you the calendars for each area that it selects?
It's being tried.
A reference, Howard Rheingold at Stanford is working on a book on internet literacy, digital literacy, which goes a little bit, I think his stuff lies on top of your stuff because he's talking about verification
mm-hmm.
and what you can believe and how to deal with all the information. But hopefully you've talked to him or will talk to him. As someone who does a calendar, I'm primarily interested in social media and energy, and I did a similar thing in the 1990s, and I've been doing it for a weekly for the last year as a listserv and as a web page. I've looked at 65 colleges and universities in the Boston area, and there are four that have an RSS feed for events. Just four. Okay. So I'm not sure you can do the database scouring that you want to do because I don't think that the universities and colleges have bought into that. There's a secondary level that I see. So a couple of weeks ago, on the same day, at 5 o'clock, the lead person for climate change for the World Bank was talking at Harvard. At 6 o'clock, there was a reception. At 6:30, he was taken to dinner. At 7 o'clock, the energy clubs from all of the colleges and universities were having a mixer. Now, I am almost 100% sure that the guy from the World Bank did not know that the students who are most interested in energy, and there are like 1,000 kids at MIT who are in the energy club. You know, there's like 600 at BU. These are really fired up people who are interested in climate change. Would he have wanted to be at that mixer? I think yes. And there was absolutely no way for him to know unless I went up to him and said, hey, by the way. So there's a whole bunch of opportunities that are missing because people aren't putting data in a congruent format, and there's no central or distributed way to get that information.
Yeah, I'm not trying to turn people into propeller heads. That's the last thing. I mean, I've learned that lesson, right? You know, I want people to be able to appreciate some fundamental things, and I think that they need to. And so one of them is, you know, what is the status of the data that I put into Facebook? Right. You know, what would it look like if Facebook got its data from me? Right. And other places got that same data from me versus others. Yeah. Joel?
So your talk very much reminded me of my days at the World Wide Web Consortium.
I bet.
Particularly, I mean, we'd have many arguments where we would say to the world, please just use structured data. And just like even the idea that seems intrinsically simple to me, separate content from presentation, that was a hard sell for many, many years.
Still is.
And some people would push back and say, look, ordinary users do not understand this. Don't even try. Though nonetheless, we would still try. And they'd say, what you have to do is make the tools do the right thing and don't bother the users with this stuff. Mm-hmm. And that irks me as a propeller head, but I'm somewhat sympathetic to it.
No, it's absolutely true.
In that it seems to me that now what has really changed is not that somehow people, and particularly kids, get the web. They don't when you actually ask them about things. Siva Vadhyanathan has written a really good article about that question of his kids don't know anything about HTML. My students don't. I mean, they Twitter all day, but they don't know what's going on, these architectural principles. But it is now a couple of very large or even distributed companies' interest to let people share information freely between themselves. That's what's changed. We haven't had any sort of new literacy. And so then I'm just, do you have any thought with respect to that? It's really not a pedagogical undertaking, but really a sort of marketplace issue where if it's in companies' interest to make the tools, to make the sharing of information more easy, then it will happen. Otherwise, it won't.
Right. Yeah, it's so in the case of Facebook, it's actually quite interesting because it recently became possible to search through the Graph API. Right. So I was able to actually add Facebook as one of the sources. If you spin up one of these hubs, you can say use Facebook also. Right. And it's quite interesting because it turns out that you can't search the location field currently in the Graph API. Right. So what I realized is that some of the events from Facebook people that I knew in my community were showing up on the calendar and others weren't. And when I looked at it, it turned out that that when I searched for Keene, New Hampshire, it was only those Facebook records that had Keene, New Hampshire in the title of the event that were being found. That was the only thing that was visible to search, right? Not the location field. And so the workaround right now, which is dreadful, is to tell people, if you want to have your thing show up, put the location in the title, right? But what that goes to is, we are actually in this world now where we're needing to start to be aware of how stuff shows up through different lenses that we care about, right? And how can we influence how stuff shows up through these different lenses, right? And so it's not all up to the providers of the services, right? You know, we, by being intelligent and thoughtful and creative users of services, can bend them to our needs and our ambitions and our goals, right? And that's an important fact. Yeah.
In order to have an environment where people really do, you know, own their own data and export it freely through syndication, don't you want to have it so that everybody's running their own RSS servers, ICS servers, whatever, on their own machines and exporting it? So that it's just as natural for somebody to be running a server as to be running a web client.
Yeah, I mean,
of course, that means that people need to be. That means that people need to have their machines always on 24/7.
No, it doesn't, because we have this cloud thing going on now, right? I mean, here's the end game in my view, right? The end game is you are born, you are given a social security number, right, and you are given a key, cryptographic key, to some place in the cloud for your stuff. Right, and as you go through your life, your stuff goes there first, right? And canonically,
is that
right?
Better than me running my own server and exporting stuff, you know, from this device that has a URL that's well known?
No, I mean if you can keep that going, but most people will prefer the automatic transmission, right?
Yeah.
Right. And your stuff is in a place that you control, and that you then assert policy over. Right? You say, you know what, I went to the dentist, I got an x-ray taken, the x-ray is up here in my store, right? I can syndicate it back to the dentist because he actually needs it for the purposes of this, but you know, I don't have any question about if I go to another state.
Born with a personal data store.
This is the thing that you guys have started to talk about in the last year, personal data store. Yeah, this is the end game.
Yeah, personal data ledger. Do you want to take questions?
Sure.
Okay. So Scott McCloud. I'm going to start with the end. What are the limitations to Elm City scaling? He specifically mentions, my question to John is, how can ICAL scale? They take the World University and school Wikipedia, MIT OpenCourseWare, potentially all 3,000, 8,000 languages with infinite open subjects, all with calendars for people to teach to.
So it just scales the same way that the web scales, which is you have, you know, files sitting around in various places and lists that enumerate those files. It's no different, right? I mean, it's the same stuff.
You don't see a problem.
No, I don't. Okay. I don't think that's the problem. I mean, there's lots of other problems. I don't think that's the problem.
Okay.
How tied is it to Azure?
It is. So the deal is, you could use the service right now for free. Anybody can. And if you wanted to run some business on it, like you were a newspaper and you actually wanted to use this thing, no one has yet, then you can because it's under an Apache 2.0 license. So you could take it and run it on your own instance of Azure, right? So yeah, I mean it's bound to Azure in the sense that, you know, a Google app in App Engine is bound to App Engine, right? That's the platform. Yeah.
A slight technical question. I was curious, since you're speaking about copy by reference and value and identity, I'll just note that those aren't simple things. Like, again, at W3C, there were huge battles about whether we should have URLs or URNs or URIs and what the differences are. And again, that's pretty propeller head. But with the events, how do you keep a loop from forming in that it gets syndicated and syndicated? Like, oh, he sent, and I noticed in the XML there was a UID field and a pro PID field. Is it expected that you would look at the unique ID and say, even though I'm getting this from a different syndicated source who got it from over there, and now I'm getting it from this person, I know these are the same two events based on some sort of unique ID?
Yeah, if it got to that point, that's how it would work, right? I mean, iCalendar has this notion of a UID per event, right? You know, on a more basic level, though, you know, what I'm trying to, in terms of sort of passing by reference versus passing by value, you know, the packet of information that is flowing on this little event network is aggressively minimal, right? It is nothing but a title, a start date time, and a link.
Right? How do you send an update?
So because it's PubSub, right? I mean, you know, that's the notion, right? Is that I want, you know, I don't want to figure out how the packet that contains the event information can contain all possible permutations of how you'd want to represent an event, right? I want to get a link onto some timeline that can come to someone's attention that can then, you know, the assumption is that everything is sitting at its source in its fully articulated form, right? So in the end, if you're going to come to this event, you know, you're going to hope that a link showed up someplace, you know, for a day that you cared about, but you're going to click through to the Harvard site, you know, to read out, you know, read more about it, find out, you know, maybe it did change and so on. Yeah.
You mentioned a couple times the authoritative calendar maker, and I wondered if there's a concern about authority and whether you could have, for example, and this doesn't arise in the context of weblogs, because a blog entry is distinct and unique. Mm-hmm. There's not a right or wrong blog entry or an authoritative one.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas you could have multiple people contributing entities or contributing entries about a single event with differing information.
Mm-hmm.
Is it up to the user then to decide if he's drawing feeds from multiple people what the sovereign entry is, or?
So there's a notion of a curator, right? So the hub is a registry of feeds, right? And a mechanism for aggregating those feeds, right? So the curator could be anybody. Let's say the curator is somebody at a chamber of commerce or somebody at a newspaper, right? So the curator is going to make an editorial decision about what feeds to include, right? What I'd like to be the case is that, you know, every possible source is available as a feed, and then what we wind up with is multiple sort of overlapping views onto that undifferentiated pool of sources according to purpose and interest. You know, it has, you know, the spam question always comes up, and this is, you know, this is actually one of those other still kind of unappreciated properties of the PubSub architecture, right? Is, you know the notion that if I'm on a mailing list, right, and you're blasting stuff at me, I can ask you to take me off the mailing list, right, and hope that you comply. But I can't force you to comply, right? I might ultimately have to, like, rat hole your stuff, right? If I'm subscribing to you, right, there's no question about it, right? I'm in control. So I have the curator. You know, I had this conversation with our Chamber of Commerce. They said, well, you know, I see this radical group here, and I don't want, you know, their stuff coming through our feed. It's like, fine, don't include it, right? you know, or you know, a lot of these event hubs right now are in the labor-intensive business of trying to vet and monitor this stuff, and they often end up doing it on a per event level. Like newspapers have to do that; they have to actually look at every event, right? But you know, the notion is that if you kind of think about this feed network, so let's say you're the newspaper in my town, and you're the hospital, right? And the hospital has a whole set of events that they publish. You know, there's the yoga for moms, and there's the brain injury support group, right? And all this stuff, right? So you, the newspaper, get to say, do I trust, you know, Tom at the hospital, right? I actually know the guy, right? I trust him. Okay, we trust each other. I take your feed, right? I don't have to look at that stuff now, right? It's a set of things, you know, that is clean with respect to spam, right? And if Tom abuses the trust, I revoke it, right? So it actually, you know, you get this interesting leverage in terms of managing the spam.
One last question.
Yeah.
In some sense, we have the eyeballs web out there. Everything's designed to be viewed by a human being.
Yeah.
A lot of other people would be talking about this next generation as services web, and that's not a term you're using here. Why are you contextualizing it as data web as opposed to services? Do you see some advantage in that or something that we should take away in comparison to the other framing of it?
No. Okay. No.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you very much.